Mr. Sullivan.
May it please the court, my name is Barry Sullivan. I represent the appellant, Stephen Giroux. In 1999, Your Honors, Rome acquired Morton. Giroux was then a senior executive and president of one of Morton's important divisions. He was terminated. He was 56 years old. He'd worked for Morton for 10 years. He was making about $700,000 in salary and bonus, but not including benefits. He was the beneficiary of a change of control agreement called the Morton Agreement. And in connection with the termination, Mr. Giroux was offered a new, quote, employment agreement, the Rome Agreement. It was delivered and signed on August 24, 1999, about 3 weeks after his actual employment ceased, but was made effective July 31st, the date of his termination. There are three provisions in this agreement that are the focus of this case, Your Honors. First, Section 2 establishes a 3-year employment period. Section 3 lays out the rights and obligations of the parties during that 3-year period. And Section 5 describes Rome's obligations in various circumstances of termination. These three provisions are basically the same as in the Morton Agreement. Under Section 5D of the Rome Agreement, Giroux is entitled to about $4 million. He's received that, and that's not in dispute. What is disputed is his entitlement to benefits under Section 3B, which are worth between $4 and $4.5 million, we think. Defendants took the position in the district court that Giroux was not entitled to these benefits, and the district court agreed. The district court held that Section 5 trumps Section 3 so that the benefits provided by Section 5D were exclusive. The district court essentially said that a construction of the agreement which provided benefits as termination benefits under Section 5 and benefits for the period of employment under Section 3, but that simply wasn't a reasonable construction of the agreement. In reaching that conclusion, the court focused on Section 3, and the court thought that the question was this: whether Section 3 benefits should be deemed to continue simply because Section 3 does not explicitly state that those benefits will cease in the event of termination. The court answered that question in the negative. And it's true, of course, that Section 3 does not say that Rome's Section 3 obligations will cease upon termination. And we believe that's significant. But that's not the entirety of our argument, Your Honors. There are three additional things that we depend on. First, what Section 3 does say. Under Section 3B, Rome promised to compensate Giroux during this 3-year period for salary, bonus, and certain welfare benefits. Second, the language and structure of Section 5. More precisely, what Section 5D, the relevant section, says about Rome's obligations in the event of termination as compared to what Sections 5A, B, and C say with respect to termination. And third, the fact that Section 3 exists at all in a document that was drafted and executed at a time when Giroux already had been fired, but yet was providing for a 3-year period of employment. We believe that Section 5D and Section 3B can both be given effect, and that is what contract interpretation law requires. On the other hand, the district court's reading renders Section 2 and most of Section 3 surplusage, as well as critical provisions of Sections 5A, B, and C. Moreover, contrary to what the district court held when it held that it wasn't reasonable to read this agreement as providing benefits under both sections. It is not the case that reading this agreement and to say that it means what it says necessarily leads to absurd results. I'd like to first talk about Section 5, because defendant's argument assumes Section 5D was intended to be the exclusive source of benefit in the event of termination without cause. But I think that the language and the structure of Section 5 as a whole is to the contrary. Section 5 parses Rome's obligations in four types of termination situations: death, disability, cause, and without cause. Sections 5, A, B, and C, which deal with the first
three. Your inference that your client gets the benefits of all things that weren't removed because irrelevant suggests that he gets death and disability benefits too, because at the time he was let go, he was clearly not yet dead, yet there was a death benefit provision. If he doesn't get the death benefits, however, why does the existence of paragraph 3 imply that he gets the benefits associated with being employed when he wasn't employed?
Well, I think that, you know, what this really comes down to, Your Honor, is that this agreement doesn't scan like a Chopin etude. But the fact of the matter is that I think that I gather
it was just taken over from the Morton agreement.
That's correct.
Which was written at a time when he might indeed die or remain employed or any of the following in the event of a change of control.
This is true. And I think that probably the most reasonable explanation of this is that as people were scurrying in this multi-billion-dollar takeover to complete the process, the expectation was that it would be signed before the termination date, and in which case 5A, B, and C would have been perfectly applicable. Suppose that Morton found out after the agreement was signed that Mr. Giroux had been guilty of misconduct and didn't want to pay him for that.
Mm-hmm.
Then it seems to me that part of the agreement would clearly come into play. But what happened in this case was that despite the fact that they tried to get the agreement in place, they obviously failed. But I think that the important thing is that with respect to each of these subsections that are all of a part, the other three all say that, and emphatically so, that the agreement will terminate without further obligations to Giroux. And there's a certain parallelism in all four sections.
But of course, 5D can't say that because there were further obligations to Giroux. If it had said that, then 5D would have been internally inconsistent.
No, but what the other three sections say, Your Honor, is that except for the obligations that are set forth, for instance, in Section B of 5B, that there shall be no further obligations. There are, in some of these provisions, there are, just as in 5D, there are some further obligations provided. But in each of these sections, except for 5D, it says that except for those that are provided herein, there shall be no further obligations. Now, I think that the way that these four subparts fit together is that there is clearly a higher price that is being exacted in the case of a termination without cause than there would be in one of these other terminations.
Is there any economic sense in a contract that says that if a man is retained and put in a broom closet for 3 years, he's entitled to his salary, see paragraph 3. But if he's fired and can therefore go take some other employment subject to the non-compete clause, he's entitled to a whole raft of benefits plus his salary. Would any rational employer ever fire the man? They just put him in a broom closet and tell him to hang upside down like a bat by his feet for 3 years.
Well, I don't think that they could do that in this case, Your Honor, because I believe that that would be grounds for him to terminate the contract, in which case the same benefit would come to him. Under Section 3, they certainly can't put him in a broom closet and pay him for 3 years. Now, the other part, the other answer to your question, though, Your Honor, is that it seems to me that they did have the option in this case of continuing to employ him for 3 years in a position that was comparable to the position that he held. And they obviously chose not to do that. And it seems to me that that makes perfect economic sense, that he is going to get both of these sets of benefits because they made the decision not to retain him. Now, as I was saying, I think that it does make economic sense also in the sense that it is a higher price that is being exacted in the case of a termination without cause. But that was the very purpose for which the Morton Agreement was written in the first place, not to provide additional benefits in the event of death or disability or terminations for cause, but to aid in recruiting and retaining a 17-member cohort of senior executives who faced a possible takeover and, as is common in these circumstances, probably would face, in the event of a takeover, termination without cause in late middle age.
Mr. Sullivan, where did the Morton Agreement itself come from?
I'm not sure I understand the question you're asking.
The world is full of golden parachute agreements, of which this is one example. Where did Morton get its golden parachute agreement from? Was it uniquely drafted for Morton? Was it come from golden parachutes elsewhere? Can we get any benefit from how they have been interpreted?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I do know that the Morton Agreement was an agreement that was used not only with respect to Mr. Giroux, but with respect to the entire cohort.
It would surprise me, though, if a lawyer drafting a golden parachute agreement at the time the Morton Agreement was drafted would do so wholly in a vacuum without having consulted secondary sources or looked at what other such things provided.
I'm sure that's the case, Your Honor, but it is surprising to me in this case that that Rome makes the argument that it just cut and pasted this agreement and without much sense of what the provisions meant or how they
fit together. I'm much less worried about what Rome did on the spur of the moment than what the Morton Agreement itself was doing, because it had the same basic structure.
Right.
Neither side has told us about where it came from or what other litigation there's been about agreements of this sort, but given the amount of money involved and the fact that these takeovers are often hostile, it would just surprise me that there was no comparable litigation.
Well, we have not, if we had authority to say to Your Honor, we certainly would
I'm
have.
I'm sure you would have.
And let me also just say, I see that I'm eating into my rebuttal time. But I want to apologize to the court for a stray set of quotation marks on the final page of my brief, which I'm sure never again will I try to make changes at the last minute. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Handler.
May it please the court, Steve Handler on behalf of the defendants. The plaintiff's argument, as expressed in the district court.
Do you know where this came from?
Pardon?
Do you know where this, where the Morton agreement came from?
It came, I believe it's a Wachtell-Lipton work product, but we have not been
able
to find...
Well, Wachtell-Lipton has a book of golden parachute agreements, so this thing has got to be parallel to things that have been in litigation elsewhere.
Well,
but
believe me, we as they look.
All right. I'm sure all the keywords were typed into Lexis and Westlaw, and you came up with
that. We had some very good people on both sides looking at that, and we could
just
not
a
find
surprise. Those. Well, such is life.
The plaintiff's interpretation of this agreement makes no economic sense, would render the entirety of Section 5D meaningless, and would produce other absurd results. Section 5D1 has a definition of accrued obligations. Actually, it is refers to accrued obligations, capitalized terms, the definitions in 5A. But under those accrued obligations, because Mr. Giroux was employed on July 31st, he received $250,000. And that was calculated in a number of ways, one of which incorporated something in 3B2, but the other ways related to a pro rata amount for bonuses and long-term compensation. He received his salary up through July 31st. All of that would be meaningless if, under Section 3B, he was entitled to receive 100% of those things for 3 years. Same thing under 5D3. 5D3 specifically incorporates two of the eight provisions of Section 3B. There would be absolutely no reason for that if all of the provisions of 3B continued for 3 years, as the plaintiff says. And it's really the same thing with the provisions under 5D2. There would be no reason to give Mr. Giroux an extra 1.25 years' salary on top of the 3 years' salary that was moved to the non-compete provision, so a total of 4.25 years' salary, if he was his salary under 3B continued for 3 years. No reason to give him a pension enhancement for 3 years if 3B3 continued for 3 years. All that would be rendered meaningless under their interpretation of this agreement. It would also produce absurd results. On appeal, they're not seeking to get all the benefits under 3B. They say, well, we're just seeking a couple of those. But there's no logical distinction between those benefits. If he's entitled to the benefits under 3B for 3 years, then he's entitled to everything. That means he gets a vacation after his job has been terminated. He gets business expenses.
He gets that automatically, doesn't he?
Pardon?
He gets that automatically.
That's my point. That's exactly my point. I mean, I don't know what a vacation means after you've been terminated. Does that mean you go back to work for 2 weeks? I don't know, and I'm not needing to be flipped, but it makes no sense. It produces an absurd result. He gets business expenses paid when he does, when he's not working. His job has been ended. He gets an office, he gets a secretary, he gets a car to do company business when he has no company business. Also, as we point out in our brief, if you take their argument about during the employment period and apply it to 3A1, where that language applies, they couldn't have terminated him. And obviously, this contract provided for a termination without cause. And in fact, again, 5D would be rendered meaningless because 5D specifically states what are the benefits he is to receive if he is terminated without cause. And if I heard Mr. Sullivan right, when Judge Easterbrook, you asked his question about hanging him upside down in a broom closet, the
Mr. Sullivan said, well, he could walk away. So what they're saying under their provision is not only do you get 2 3-year salaries plus a prorated portion of your salary if you get terminated without cause, on day one of this agreement, you could walk away, get 3-year salary under your non-compete, get 3-year salary under 3B, plus your pro rata section under 5B. That makes no economic sense, none. Now, 5D, our interpretation of 5D is not in any way inconsistent with the language in 5A through C. In those sections, there is one benefit provided after termination. With death or disability, it's the accrued obligations. With if it's a termination for cause, it's just salary. Here, as Judge Kennelly pointed out, and I believe Judge Easterbrook mentioned, there's a laundry list of things. I mean, if the sentences were structured the same way, your dependent clause would be about 6 times as long as your independent clause. It's very clear. 5D says, in the event of a termination of without cause, here's a laundry list of things you get. There's nothing inconsistent with that, and the language of 5A through C. There is only one and only one reasonable way to interpret this agreement to give effect to all of its provisions, and that is the way that the district court said. That is, because both sections, 3B, 5D, use the during the employment period language. And the only way to put them together is the way the district court said. 3B defines Mr. Giroux's duties, obligations, compensation, and benefits while he is employed during the employment period. And 5D talks about what benefits he gets if he is terminated without cause during the employment period. That's exactly what happened here. He was terminated without cause. He was given the benefits provided by that section, and they all read together. Unless the court has any...
What about the attorneys?
Well, that's a sort of an open-ended question, Judge Haney. Our position is that this was a pretty clear-cut case. We paid $500,000 for them to litigate it fully before the district court. They lost. The fees, we think the fees that would have been or have been incurred on appeal were not reasonably incurred in light of, that's the language of the section, and that they shouldn't get anything further.
Are you asking us to make that decision?
No.
Or should we remand to the district court to make that decision?
It's your choice as to whether to make that decision or to remand it for that decision to be made. It's totally up to you, and we're not saying you should do one or the other.
Are you saying that it's not reasonable because this lawsuit is frivolous?
I'm saying that the appeal is frivolous after all that has gone on. I can understand how someone is entitled to their day in court and is... this isn't part of the record, but you know, we wrote a letter outlining our legal position. The matter went on. We paid the fees. Judge ruled. I think Judge Kennelly gave a rather very thoughtful decision in outlining this. If going back to the language this court has adopted, if this was Mr. Giroux's own nickel, would he be here? Would we be here if he didn't think he had a way to shift this? Would we have been gone through everything in the district court? I don't think so. I think...
Of course, if we buy the Appley's position, there's several million dollars involved, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question about that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Handler. Anything further, Mr. Sullivan?
I'd just like to make a couple of points, Your Honor. First of all, the answer to the last question is that no matter whose dime it is, Mr. Giroux would be here. And I think that the reason for that, as succinctly as possible, is that Rome has struggled mightily to say what this employment period provisions sections 2 and 3 mean, and why their reading of the agreement doesn't render them surplusage. We've had the explanation that the employment period lasts a second. We've had the explanation that the employment period lasts a day. The fact of the matter, Your Honors, is that to give effect to Section 3 and to Section 2, our reading is the only reading that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The case will be taken under advisement.